making its passage through the UK Parliament before passing through the House of Lords. In the latest move by the government to clamp down on a number of issues, including what they claim is unlawful disruption. However, the move, which aims to give the police more power to carry out their duties, has actually produced more of the very thing which critics claim is the whole reason the bill came into being in the first place, which is, of course, the very legitimate and critical right to protest. In 2020, mass demonstrations took place around the country from both Black Lives Matter supporters, galvanized by the mass global movements for justice following the murder of George Floyd in the United States, and also environmental activists, raising alarm over the growing climate emergency. The protests for racial justice were wide-reaching. People from all walks of life in Britain, especially young people who took to the streets, were demanding racial justice, not only concerned about anti-black racism in the United States of America, but also about deep and evident systemic racism in the United Kingdom. Environmental protesters and demonstrations also swept across the country, with some in London causing disruption to public transport in order to get their message across and to get their voices heard. And getting the message to the forefront of public debate is precisely the point of the protests. While the British government has focused on the toppling of statues and of the inconvenience to those using London trains to get to work to justify more police power, the reality is that should the police bill become law, it will likely be exploited to shut down very legitimate and lawful protests, with critics alarmed that the authorities will have the legal means to shut down and stifle any real criticism of the government at all. The problems of racial inequality, injustice, and of corruption and incompetence within the UK government, in many people's eyes, far outweigh and are of far greater concern than protesters stepping beyond the bounds of so-called legality. The right to protest in the United Kingdom is something purportedly sacred and is often talked about as being an essential cornerstone of Britain's so-called democracy. And yes, sometimes protests can get heated. But remember too that there are often serious questions about the conduct of the police, who many would argue themselves operate outside of the law, while at times being accused of breaking the law while operating with complete impunity. There has to be a balance, and listening to the concerns of legal experts and those with a keen eye on the importance of civil liberties, it isn't hard to see why there are serious concerns about the UK police having more powers. Many argue that the UK police need to correctly manage the existing powers which they already have, and not be given more powers, which, as well as giving the police the power to keep people off the streets indefinitely, will also arguably impact and devastate the lives of Britain's traveller communities. Traveller communities have a way of life which is thousands of years old, and there are serious worries that the new police bill will be used in order to legally control their freedom of movement and to do the opposite of facilitating their way of life. Such communities are part of Britain's multicultural society and should have the same rights as everyone else, and should not be treated as a nuisance to be pushed to the margins as the authorities see fit. The truth is that the British government was terrified by the collectivised message and power of protest movement last year, and in particular of the effectiveness of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the ability of such demonstrations to galvanise and inspire people to challenge power and the status quo. Also worth remembering is that a Metropolitan Police officer was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard. Some argue that there are serious problems within the police themselves, institutionally, which need rooting out, because they're given any more authority to adjudicate over the right of the public to mobilize, even if at times protests might become disruptive and hard for them to manage. When apartheid in South Africa was brought to an end, it was because mass global protests took place demanding it. And without such global protests, much needed change would have been jeopardized. Huge protests also just took place in London, demanding an end to apartheid in Palestine, with some even arguing that there were the biggest show of solidarity in the streets for the Palestinians which have ever taken place in Britain. This is something to be celebrated. But according to a new report, British media coverage of the recent Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip was biased against Palestinians and skewed public impressions. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring analysed the British media coverage of the conflict in a 44-page report entitled Media Reporting on Palestine 2021. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring stated that during the 11-day war, there were 62,400 online print articles and 7,997 television broadcasts in the United Kingdom reporting on the incidents. The report has revealed that while there were some examples of balanced coverage, the overall narrative was unbalanced due to the skewed language, misleading headlines, and problematic framing. Rizwana Hamid, director of the Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring and co-author of the report, told the Middle East Eye that the overwhelming amount of complaints about British media's biased coverage of events in Palestine aligned with the analysis and evidence of the monitoring organization. The report found that half of the broadcast media clips in the United Kingdom between 7th and 10th of May referred to the situation in Sheikh Jarrah neighbourhood of the city of Al-Quds as an eviction or real estate dispute, which justifies the forced displacements of Palestinians, while the Israeli action were in contravention of international laws. Regarding Israeli police brutality against Palestinian protesters and worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the investigation highlighted numerous examples of media sources utilizing terminology such as clashes, conflict, scuffles, and skirmishes to suggest equal blame. Rizwana Hamid said, as far as language is concerned, terms such as evictions mask the illegal forced removals and expulsion of Palestinians from their homes, adding that references to conflict and clashes try to equalize what is in effect a battle between David and Goliath. The Muslim Council of Britain's Centre for Media Monitoring also cited several news reports speaking of an intifada, which is said played into fear-mongering and framing Palestinians as violent aggressors. Thus, more protests calling to kill the bill regarding the proposed police powers have also been taking place, and they will continue. It's abundantly clear that the British people do not want this bill to become law and value their right to protest and to speak truth to power as sacred. Rather than ploughing ahead with its current plans, for once this current government should listen to the demands of what seems to be the vast majority of the British people. In fact, people's demand to protest and assemble is a fundamental right of any free society and is the essence of free speech. The British government seeking the power to shut this down wherever they see fit is draconian and is the opposite of what people expect from a decent democracy.
You're listening to Hosseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Razavian. لبيك يا حسين.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله. My condolences to you, brothers and sisters, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Welcome to the program Husseiniyya. We were talking about benefiting from Ziyarat Ashura and the spiritual journey of Ziyarat Ashura and benefiting from the many lessons of Ziyarat Ashura. We talked about last time that Bala is the core and center of Ashura. Bala means trials, tribulations, and that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was tested. We learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam as he was the most bravest, the most courageous, the most patient when it came to Bala. We learn from him that when we have difficulties in our own lives, that we need to be strong, that we need to have forbearance. And that is one of the great lessons of Ashura, is that it teaches us to overcome our difficulties. When we think about our own difficulties, there are ways that we can learn to overcome them. As you know, if we want to enjoy life, if you want to have a good life, life is about minimizing pain, dealing with pain and troubles and tribulations, and about maximizing joy. Therefore, in Islam, when we are believers and we want to reach God, we try to maximize our joy, maximize our worship, maximize our connection to God, because we truly believe that God is the ultimate source of joy and happiness for us. At the same time, when we are in this world that is surrounded with bala and calamity, and trials and tribulations, we try to minimize, to make sure that we can deal with our pains, and therefore we will have a happiness, we'll have a happy life, we'll have sa'adat, felicity. One of the steps that we can manage our trials and tribulations is to first of all be aware that bala exists for everybody. It is not as if you're only facing trials and tribulations. It's not as if you're only facing difficult times. When we look at the Holy Quran, we read verses, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدْ, that we have certainly created man into hardship. That God is telling us that this hardship exists for everybody. This is a world that we are supposed to be tried. This is a world that we are going to be tested. Or we see in different narrations that this world is darun bil bala mahfufa, that this world is covered with bala. We cannot think that you're going to have ease in all types in terms of our life. There might be areas, there might be times that life is difficult for us. Therefore, we have to first of all be aware that bala is an essential part of this world. But what can we do to overcome this bala? There are steps that inshallah we can learn from the hadith, and inshallah we can learn from verses of the Holy Quran. One of these is that we have to have action. We have to know that bala happens because of different reasons. Sometimes bala happens to us and calamities happen to us because it's our own fault. We were not careful. We did not plan right. We are at fault. We didn't do our due diligence, right? Second of all, we have to understand that some of this bala that happens to us is because of our own actions, our own sins. That when you break away from the harmony of the universe, when you break away from the laws of God, that you are being susceptible, making yourself susceptible to bad things happening to us. For example, there are sins that we do that can take away our rizq and provisions. There are sins that God forbid somebody does, that God can shorten his lifespan. Therefore, we have to understand that we have to prepare ourselves, plan, use our reasoning, use our intellect, and have a good plan for ourselves to make sure that we are staying away from harm. And second of all, it is a more spiritual answer that we are careful about how we can act and about disobeying our Lord, disobeying God, that this itself will bring bala for us. And to make this clear, we understand that for the prophets and their vicegerents and their successors, bala happens to them because of tarfid, to elevate their rank. But bala happens to those that are sinners because of their own actions. This is not a bala that happens, say, to Imam Hussein. That what befell Imam Hussein was because of a test that Allah wanted to elevate his rank. Therefore, in this Muharram, inshallah, we can deal more with our bala, learn more about dealing with bala from understanding Imam Hussein's movement.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry, while innocent children die. Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein.
Welcome back. We were talking about bala being the core and the center of Ashura and learning from Ziyarat Ashura lessons. And one of those lessons is how to deal with our own trials and tribulations, how to stay away from harm, how to protect ourselves. Imam Ali alayhi salam in a tradition teaches us. He says, إِذَا نَزَلَ بِكَ مَكْرُوهُ فَانْظُرْ فَإِنْ كَانَ لَكَ هِيلًا فَلَا تَعْجِزْ. If makruh or bad or affliction or something that you do not like descends upon you, look and see if there is a hila. Look and see if there is a solution. If there is a solution, فَلَا تَعْجِزْ. Don't be weak. Find the solution. Many of the problems we face can be remedied by solutions. For example, if somebody has problems in marriage, there are many steps that they can take to resolve these issues, to see counselors, to seek counsel, to get advice from their friends and family, to get advice from people that are qualified, from the scholars, and to remedy their marriage. And they learn how to treat their spouse properly, inshallah they'll have a good marriage. If we have problems with our financial situation, as we learn from this tradition, if there is a hila, if there's a solution, don't be weak, don't be lazy. Study hard, get a good education, work hard, and inshallah you'll get good sustenance, you'll get good rizq, be organized. You know, come to work on time, and you, inshallah, have a good sustenance. These are solutions that are in our own hands, that are in our own disposal. But then Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about other trials and tribulations. وَإِن لَمْ يَكُنْ فِيهِ هِيلًا فَلَا تَجْزَعْ. But there are other makruh or other trials and tribulations that happen to us that are not in our own hands, that we cannot do anything about. What do we do then? What does Imam Ali alayhi salam tell us to do? For the first part, he says, لا تعجز, don't be weak, solve the problem. In the second part, it is narrated that he says, لا تجزع, don't have جزع, don't be anxious, don't be worried, don't break apart, be patient. So for us to remedy our problems, we can divide them into two parts. One are problems that we can resolve, inshallah, with prayer, with dua, with, inshallah, working hard, with not sinning, abstaining from sin. Many of our calamities will be, you know, separated from us. And then there are those other groups of calamities that Imam Ali says, when they fall upon you, لا تعجز out. These are calamities that happen to good people, that happen to other good people like the prophets and their successors. Some of the traditions say that the most amount of calamity happens on the prophets and their successors. So know that Allah is testing you. Be happy that He wants to elevate you in rank, that He wants good for you, that He wants you to come out of this world as a tried person, a person that has been tried and that has won and been successful in their tests. There are also other methods for us to deal and manage our bala and manage our pains. When we look at some of the other solutions, one is the connection that we have and the love that we have in this world. It makes us more susceptible for bala. The more you're attached to this world, the more you're susceptible when Allah takes it away from you, that you will be feeling very sad, that you'll be feeling in great grief because you're attached to it. So one of the ways that we can make ourselves stronger people, one of the ways that we can separate ourselves and make ourselves less susceptible to bala is to love the world less, to like it less. Not the good parts of the world, not spirituality, not God and the creation. The world is in the lower desires, the hayat al-dunya, meaning the lower life, the material world. To have less attachment. If you love something more, if God takes it away or if it's harmed, you're going to be more upset. So if we distance ourselves from the world, whatever Allah takes away from us will be less harmed by it. One of the other methods that we can learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, learn from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, is that we can remember how Imam Hussein alayhi salam had patience and sabr. We can learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam his patience. That one of the things that we need to strengthen is this ability to deal with things that we don't like. It's called sabr. There's sabr on musibat, sabr when calamities happen, you become very strong, you become immune. And two is sabr on ma'siyat. You become you endure yourself. When it comes to sin, you become very strong and you have sabr and patience. Imam Hussein was very sabur. He had a lot of patience on the day of Ashura. On the day of Ashura, it says that some of his companions, of course, companions were in different levels. But Imam Hussein was like a mountain in Ashura. That when he saw some of them begin to become weak, that he gave them courage, he gave them patience. Inshallah, he gives us patience to deal with our trials and tribulations. In this Muharram, we learn to deal with our pains and trials and tribulations. We learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam that he instilled forbearance and patience, and he made people very strong when it came to difficult times. Inshallah, he will look at us and he'll grant us this patience. So for us to be patient, inshallah, we learn that we need to be aware that trials and tribulations and difficulty faces everybody, one. That two, we need to have action. If we can solve those problems by our intellect, by our action, we need to solve them. And if we cannot solve them, we need to have patience and forbearance, and inshallah we can learn from what Imam Hussein alayhi salam went through, and we can deal and manage our pains better, and we can have a better life, inshallah.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States and Canada, the unprecedented and deadly floods in Western Europe, the soaring temperatures across the world, and severe droughts elsewhere. These are all harbingers of a devastating climate crisis that is to come. The United Nations released its most comprehensive report on climate change yet on Monday. In the document, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said humans are to blame for the strange and tragic natural catastrophes the world is witnessing. The definite tone marked a contrast from the language used in previous reports, which had said industrial activity was extremely likely to blame. In a statement, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report a, quote, "red for humanity." The report was published less than 3 months before the United Nations Climate Change Conference 2021, which will be hosted by Scotland. IPCC findings are expected to feature prominently in the discussions.
I think it's too late to keep things as they were. What we have to do is figure out how to moderate the influences of all this. And I don't think it's going to be a pretty sight.
The UN Climate Panel, IPCC, comprises thousands of scientists across 195 countries who compile peer-reviewed research articles about global warming into a report. This year's report was written by over 230 authors who have reviewed some 14,000 research papers. The IPCC report warns that even in the case of the sharpest cuts in emission, the world might not be able to maintain the global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Accord, adding that without immediate steep cuts, the average temperatures will soar past 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Moreover, according to the report, even if the world manages to cap global warming at the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, extreme weather conditions will continue to become more common and intense. A rise in sea levels also seems inevitable, as the report says even with the most severe cuts in carbon emissions, the melting of polar ice will elevate sea levels for hundreds or even thousands of years. All is not lost, however, as the IPCC suggests there is still time to prevent a worst-case scenario. The UN panel says the world has about a decade to decrease the rate at which it pumps carbon into the atmosphere before it's too late. Activists and politicians reacted to the findings with alarm.
We're not talking about the root cause itself, the things that is actually fueling these events. We are not holding people in power accountable. We are not talking about the current best available science, what it says, and how the situation looks like now. And we are especially not talking about the gap between what politicians are saying and what they are actually doing.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the IPCC report a wake-up call, while U.S. President Joe Biden called for action to fight climate change.
I think a lot of the people who have the power and the money have absolutely no idea how bad things are, because they simply refuse to admit it, and because they're still looking at short term and making more money this quarter and getting elected next time.
Many have so far shrugged off climate warnings and believe the concept of global warming and climate change to be a hoax. But now that there are more signs of climate change than ever before, will there be a universal consensus and will to counter the devastating impact we're exerting on the planet?
Iraq and Syria have been struggling with poverty and instability for years. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and Washington and its allies' support for opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, as well as crippling economic sanctions, merely added fuel to the fire of instability there and gave birth to Daesh. Since Daesh terrorists emerged in Iraq and Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. On August 7, 2017, Daesh terrorists captured a member of an Iranian advisory support team in Syria near the Tanf border crossing in the southeast of the country. 2 days later, on August 9th, Mohsen Hojaji was beheaded by the Takfiri terrorists. The terrorist group published photos and videos of Hojaji's arrest and beheading. The act prompted widespread condemnation of the terrorist group, as well as the admiration of the soldiers who were fighting against it. In a meeting with the family of Hojaji, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed Hojaji as an emblem of sincere and courageous martyrdom and called the Takfiri groups puppets of the United States and Britain. Also, late Iranian commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Qasem Soleimani, slammed the incident as a horrific, inhumane crime that came in the wake of successive blows dealt on several fronts to Takfiri Wahhabi terrorist groups, which are linked to the world's imperialist power. He vowed not to rest until they have taken out every last terrorist from the face of the Muslim world. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, who played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists, were assassinated in Baghdad airport in January 2020 in a U.S. drone attack. Two years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took the lives of over 1 million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos that resulted from the U.S. invasion finally gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011, that later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. Add to this list the crippling sanctions against the Damascus government. The U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socio-economic conditions there.
First of all, let's say Iran is supporting all the freedom fighters in the world and fighting against the terrorists. Even, you know, like we call it, either we call it the Hujaija massacre, brutal killing by ISIS, and then al-Nusra later on. As we know that those movements, let's say, or organizations, according to what Hillary Clinton said, this is, or they were all created by United States.
Washington is directly responsible for the emergence of Daesh and the current instability and poverty that has afflicted the Iraqi and Syrian nations. Ironically, the U.S. punishes countries that are aiding Baghdad and Damascus to fight the Takfiri terrorists with economic sanctions and calls them terrorists. Aren't the real terrorists those who provide assistance for Daesh and worsen the living conditions of people by imposing economic sanctions on their countries? In a statement released on Saturday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry commemorated the Iranian diplomats and a journalist who were killed at the Consulate General of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, in August 1998. The Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned the terrorist attack, saying it was against all international laws and treaties. The body also announced that different aspects of the attack are required to be clarified, and this is a definite demand of the government and people of Iran. 23 years ago, the Taliban captured Mazar-e-Sharif. After that, the group admitted that 10 Iranian diplomats and a journalist had been killed during an attack on the Iranian consulate. The Taliban spokesman said the Iranians had been killed by renegade forces who had acted without orders. Furthermore, the ministry reiterated its call on all parties to the war in Afghanistan to end the conflict and seek a solution in the negotiations. That's while the UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has warned that the country is heading toward a, quote, catastrophe.
In the past weeks, the war in Afghanistan has entered a new, deadlier, and more destructive phase. The Taliban campaign during June and July to capture rural areas has achieved significant territorial gains. From this strengthened position, they have begun to attack the larger cities.
The Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban has also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials. The US B-52 bombers and Spectre gunships have reportedly targeted Taliban positions in northern Afghanistan. While there has been no confirmation of the airstrikes or possible damage by Taliban militants, Afghan Defense Ministry has declared that the airstrikes inflicted significant damage to the militants. The deployment of American bombers and gunships further highlights the degree of dependency of Afghan forces on US military support. Also, the development has further raised questions about the reliability of persistent claims made over the years by the US and NATO forces in Afghanistan, that they have primarily been engaged in training Afghan government forces to independently safeguard the country's security against various threats. Meanwhile, the airstrikes came as the militants advanced towards key cities. On Friday, the Taliban captured the capitals of two Afghan provinces in a matter of 24 hours, the city of Shebergan in Jawzjan and the city of Zaranj in Nimruz.
Of course, the Taliban cannot be expected to provide security to the embassies and diplomats of other countries. And as you mentioned, the incident of what happened at the Iranian embassy and the killing of Iranian diplomats was a very tragic event. But what more can we expect from Taliban? If you look at Taliban's history, if you look at Taliban's rule in Afghanistan, it's a rule of destruction, of violence and suppression. And I'm afraid we are again heading back into the situation.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122-caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of that practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for their sick political Zionist project. They try everything to forbid building a civil state because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the Sikh ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabih Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason, it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. Managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
The Light.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cleft decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite the tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into her obsession. An obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days: recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tipped sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of two baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost eight of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst the wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number two.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful, but Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice. Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalist usually frees the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.